You got a chance to mark that. If you will open your Bibles, we'll be in the book of Proverbs chapter 29 tonight. Proverbs chapter 29. When you think about the book of Proverbs, it's this collection, it seems, of oftentimes very short but wise sayings. And as you read, especially chapters 10 through 29, maybe there's a couple of ways to approach it. One is to say, well, there's these little sections and they kind of stand by themselves, and I think that a lot of times that's a good way to approach it, that maybe there's a lot of different themes, and so that might be true. Someone compared it to almost like, maybe like if a child is leaving home, a parent might just kind of give them one piece of advice after another, and that might be somewhat kind of like what Proverbs is doing in that sense. Maybe another way, though, is to think that there is sometimes, while maybe not as much of a theme or as a topic as you could say, maybe like we did this morning with Psalm 21, with Proverbs 29, and say, here's the theme of this chapter. I do think there is sometimes a progression of thought. And so there might be kind of a flow, even if at times there's a lot of different topics being covered in a chapter like this. When you begin Proverbs 29, maybe one of the first things that we're talking about is maybe like there's good government and bad government. Actually, if you go back to chapter 28 and read beginning in verse 28, it says, when the wicked arise, men hide themselves, but when they perish, the righteous increase. He who is often rebuked and hardens his neck will suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. You kind of have chapter 28, verse 28, chapter 29, verse 2, talking about government. And yet the first verse that we have in our chapter, at least, deals with this individual. He's often rebuked. There's a lot of correction coming his way. There's a need maybe for that, obviously. And yet instead of listening to the rebuke, instead of doing something about it, he simply hardens his neck. And I guess basically you could say, if you want to just boil that down, he doesn't change, he doesn't listen to the rebuke that's coming to him. And the result is that there's kind of this sudden destruction that might come upon him. If you kind of think in the book of Proverbs, that sometimes happens. If you actually go back to chapter 28 and verse 18, it says there that whoever walks blamelessly will be saved, but he who's perverse in his ways will suddenly fall. I reject wisdom, I reject good advice, and I might fall rather quickly. And you certainly see that in the lives of some people throughout the biblical text. And he says this fall is sometimes without remedy. Maybe a person gets to the point where there is not a second chance. I think sometimes whenever we do something wrong and maybe we are rebuked for it, I think, well, I can always get out of it. I can always make a change. And yet one day, of course, all of our chances will be out. In Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27, we're reminded that it's appointed for men to die once, but after this, the judgment. And also sometimes, a person might just become so calloused and hard-hearted to the point that they're not going to change. They're not going to repent as they should. As we pointed out, chapter 28, verse 28, chapter 29, verse 2, basically have some of the same types of themes. You have righteous governments, or when the righteous are in authority, there's kind of this period of rejoicing. You have wicked increase, or wicked become in power, and the people groan. That's kind of something that we find in other places in Proverbs. You could go like to chapter 28 and verse 12, and it says, when the righteous rejoice, there's great glory. But when the wicked arise, men hide themselves. You know, so there's obviously a point here that there's a good thing about having righteous government, godly government. That's something that's important. But I think also, maybe you might say, if you kind of put verse 1 in the middle of that, why is it there? Maybe sometimes you have wicked people that they rise to power. And that sometimes happens. And maybe sometimes even those people will harden their necks. Maybe the reminder is if they do that, they're going to end up destroyed as well. I think about Pharaoh, perhaps. And he was obviously a man that was in a position of authority. He was told what to do. He was rebuked again and again. He kept hardening his neck. And yet eventually he was destroyed by God. And so maybe you have some of that in the beginning of this chapter. there's some of the same themes in these next couple of verses, but slightly maybe different. In verse 3 it says, "Whoever loves wisdom makes his father rejoice, but a companion of harlots wastes his wealth. The king establishes the land by justice, but he who receives bribes overthrows it." Verse 3 kind of speaks about a son that a father can rejoice in. And maybe the connection is sort of going back to the previous verse, when righteous people are in authority, that's a cause for rejoicing as well. And so here's an individual that causes his parents to rejoice, just like godly rulers would cause the people to rejoice. And I think one of the things that we see in verse 3 is kind of a theme throughout the book of Proverbs, that is, a son's actions have an impact upon their father. I think about, these are not going to be all of them, but just some of the Proverbs that would mention that type of theme. In Proverbs chapter 10 and in verse 1, it says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is the grief of his mother." Over in Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 20, it says there that a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish man despises his mother. And chapter 23, we have a couple of sections, verses 15 and 16, where he says, "My son, if your heart is wise, my heart will rejoice, indeed I myself. Yes, my inmost being will rejoice when your lips speak right things." And then in verses 24 and 25, it says that the father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who begets a wise child will delight in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her who bore you rejoice. And then in chapter 27 and verse 11, he says there that, "My son, be wise and make my heart glad, that I may answer him who reproaches me." And so this is kind of a theme throughout the book, that a child's actions impact his parents. And in these passages, obviously, as well as father. Kind of the opposite, though, in Proverbs 29, verse 3, of this son who loves wisdom, is pictured this man who's a son, but he's a companion of harlots. That's not someone that loves wisdom in the context. In fact, if you remember early in the book of Proverbs, in Proverbs chapter 2, Proverbs is trying to give this young man wisdom to know how to walk and direct his steps. And it talks about, like in verse 12, that this wisdom will deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things. It'll deliver you, verse 16, from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. And so wisdom helps keep us away from harlots. And yet if I reject it, I don't love wisdom, I'm going to end up in that kind of company. If you were to think it's not just harlots, though, I need to be careful about, you can go to chapter 28, verse 7 of Proverbs. Proverbs 28 and verse 7 says there that whoever keeps the law is a discerning son, but a companion of gluttons shames his father. I could get in the wrong kind of crowd, whether it be harlots, whether it be gluttons, whatever it is, and that's not going to be good for my parents. And I don't need to be in that kind of crowd. That's a person that doesn't love wisdom. And a very practical result of that kind of behavior, of being a companion of harlots in Proverbs 29 and verse 3, is that the son will waste his wealth. We might think, perhaps, of the prodigal, perhaps, in Luke 15. That he goes to the far country and wastes his possessions with riotous living. We don't know maybe all that was involved in that. But obviously, his lifestyle wasted what he had been given. And then the Proverbs go back, after it deals with this son, who either loves wisdom or is a companion of harlots, and the two different sides of that. He says in verse 4, "The king establishes the land by justice, but he who receives bribes overthrows it." We're back to government again, kind of. We're back to a proverb now about kings. Maybe what we could say is that maybe a king can overthrow the land just like a son could waste the wealth he's received. Or a king could act with wisdom and he could establish the land just like a son could love wisdom and he could cause his father to rejoice. The Proverbs certainly have some things to say about how kings would establish their authority or the land would be made firm. You could think about the one that's most popular probably of Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 33, where it says, "Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people." And you also have chapter 16 and verse 12, that it's an abomination for kings to commit wickedness. It says, "For a throne is established by righteousness." Righteousness and godliness, justice, those types of things are what establishes a kingdom. Someone who loves bribes is obviously going to overthrow the kingdom. And you could say that that might involve just kind of this love of money. Well, if that's kind of what the king's ruled by, then that's going to cause him to not be someone who's a just ruler. After you kind of go through those verses, you kind of have maybe a section here that I kind of thought of as like the danger of flattery. In verse 5 it says, "A man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. By transgression an evil man is snared, but the righteous sings and rejoices. The righteous considers the cause of the poor, but the wicked does not understand such knowledge." If you were to try to make some connection between verse 4 and verse 5, it might be that one of the dangers that a king needs to watch out for, and really all of us need to watch out for, is flattery. And flattery is kind of like almost similar to bribing. Maybe sometimes people flatter me because they want me to do something for them, just like someone might give a king a bribe because they want the king to do something on their behalf. And if a king goes after this, just like if we do, we're not going to be people who love justice as we should. Verse 5, though, says flattery is like spreading a net for his feet. You know, it's dangerous. The question might be, well, whose feet are going to get caught in this net in the end of verse 5? He flatters his neighbor and he spreads a net for his feet. And I guess you could say that in some ways, flattery is kind of a trap to the person who does it, as well as a trap maybe to the person at times who receives it. I think in some ways you might set a trap for this person's feet because they might kind of believe your flattery. They might kind of fall for it. They might be led astray by it. That would be something. But oftentimes as well in the Proverbs, when you do something trying to catch someone else, it sometimes comes back on you. And so you could go to Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 10, that whoever causes the upright to go astray in an evil way, he himself will fall into his own pit, but the blameless will inherit good. And so maybe you could say it's dangerous, obviously, for both people in that situation. In verse 6, he says, "By transgression an evil man is snared, but the righteous sings and rejoices." And so evil men can get snared into sin, get kind of trapped in it. But the righteous are able to kind of avoid those traps and maybe avoid things like even the trap of flattery. He's going to recognize it for maybe what it is, and he's not going to rely upon people flattering him to feel good about himself or to feel happy. And instead, he's going to instead trust in what God's Word says. Verse 7 sort of seems to be different than 5 and 6. And it basically maybe talks about considering the poor. It says, "The righteous considers the cause of the poor, but the wicked does not understand such knowledge." And maybe you could say that if you're a person given to flattery, you might not consider the poor. The person that falls for flattery might want something from other people. And the poor could maybe give the righteous something. Also, you might say that this is something that the righteous does, just like in the end of verse 6, the righteous sings and rejoices, and here the righteous considers the cause of the poor. And so there's maybe some connection and thought there as well. This proverb seems kind of starts out, I guess you could say, similar to another proverb in Proverbs chapter 12. In Proverbs chapter 12 and in verse 10, it says, "A righteous man regards," kind of like the righteous considers. But in Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 10, it says that the righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. And we might kind of say that what a righteous man does is he considers things like the life of his animal. He's going to consider the cause of the poor. He's going to be concerned about people that maybe are helpless, that other people might not really care for. and maybe even things that are sort of helpless and can't defend themselves. And certainly I think it's good for us to remember that it's good to think about the poor and to be concerned about their needs and seek to do what we can to help them if we're going to be righteous individuals. Maybe I group kind of verses 8 through 11 together, and maybe kind of like, how do we address problems? Here's kind of different ways people address problems, maybe. Verse 8 says, "Scoffers set a city aflame, but wise men turn away wrath." I guess you could think about a scoffer setting a city aflame, and you could think about that in the sense of maybe they just stir up people's passions. Or you could think about it even in a more kind of literal sense, that you might have people that are scoffers and they literally kind of create riots and burn things, and maybe that's how they address their problems. They set a city aflame. But wise men are able to turn away wrath. They're able to maybe calm down the situation. Kind of reminds me of something in the book of Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 1, that a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. And maybe sometimes wise people know how to kind of take people that are out of control and say, let's calm the situation down. And which way do I handle problems? Which way do you handle problems? Do I just kind of get myself worked up? Do I get kind of like these scoffers? Or am I someone that says, let's calm things down, let's approach this in a more reasonable way? Verse 9 says, if a wise man contends with a foolish man. Here's some kind of contention between a wise man and a fool. And it says, whether the fool rages or laughs, there's no peace. Maybe you've been in situations where you're trying to reason with someone, you're trying to give reasonable arguments to show something is true or right. It seems like you can't get anywhere. There's never going to come any peace. There's never going to be any resolution. Because maybe that person's not as interested in reasonable arguments and following the path that leads to truth. I think it's interesting to notice what the fool does when he's maybe encountering these arguments maybe from the wise man. The text says whether he rages or laughs. Isn't that sometimes how fools respond to wisdom? They hear something wise and maybe they just mock at it and make fun of it. That would maybe be like the laughing kind of response. And then maybe sometimes a fool hears something and it's wisdom, and instead of laughing at it, it gets them mad. And so they kind of get into a rage. But no matter what his response is in that sense, it's not going to result in him maybe accepting the truth. So when problems arise, am I someone who handles them like a wise man who can use reasonable arguments? Or am I a fool who doesn't listen to such type of advice? In verse 10 it says, the bloodthirsty hate the blameless, but the upright seek his well-being. Maybe a good illustration of the bloodthirsty hating the blameless might be all the way back in Genesis chapter 4. In Genesis chapter 4, with the sons of Adam and Eve, you have the account in verse 5 of Genesis 4 that God did not respect Cain and his offering. And it says, and Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Now Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. Here you have a righteous man. You have Abel that's done what God has expected him to do. And you've got his brother Cain, who has not been righteous. And his attitude is, I don't like this person over here. And in fact, he seeks to kill him and does on that time. The end of Proverbs 29 and verse 10, where it says, the upright seek his well-being. Obviously, that's a contrast. Here's someone who hates someone in the beginning of the verse. Someone who seeks the other's well-being at the end of the verse. And so maybe I need to ask myself, which one am I? Do I get filled with hatred towards people? maybe even especially people that are doing the right things? Or am I someone who seeks the other's well-being? When I think about that, certainly you might could say, well, maybe is he seeking the well-being of this bloodthirsty man? Well, I think that upright would do that. He loved his enemy. He maybe will also seek the well-being of the blameless man in the beginning of the verse as well, because they're going to maybe be of similar character. But I think there's a good contrast to make us think about our own actions. Verse 11 says, "A fool vents all his feelings, but a wise man holds them back." What do I do when I'm in a problem? What do I do when maybe I'm getting angry? Someone that just vents everything, acts impulsively and without much restraint. I think about in Proverbs 14, verse 29, it says that he who is slow to wrath has great understanding, but he who is impulsive exalts folly. Fool just kind of is impulsive, just does whatever comes, vents his feelings, lets them out. It says here, though, that the wise man holds them back. Something that was interesting is that word, kind of that phrase there for like holds them back, how it's used in some other places. If you go to Psalm 65, and Psalm 65 and in verse 7, this is kind of the same type of terms that are used for the calming of a storm or the sea's waves. And so in Psalm 65 and verse 7, it says, "You who still the noise of the seas, the voice of their waves, and the tumult of the peoples." And you're going to have some of that same words there when you talk about things like stilling the seas. And Psalm 89 and verse 9, the same type of thing. Psalm 89, 9, "You rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them." Kind of the idea of God's holding them back. Do I have that ability to do that with my feelings? Maybe they're there, but I'm going to kind of be slow to breath. I'm not going to just blow up. I'm not just going to lose control. Now, wise men, as we've noted, have the ability to calm down a situation where others are out of control, verse 8, and they know how to control themselves and their feelings when you get to verse 11. So maybe some things maybe about how we handle problems. The next section maybe would be, I would ask us to think about the question maybe like, what do I pay attention to? Verse 12 says, "If a ruler pays attention to lies, all his servants become wicked." So maybe we're kind of back on the king again. And if he pays attention to people that lie to him, well, that's going to spread and everybody's going to be wicked around him. Most of us are not kings. Or maybe not even at times rulers in that sense. But what I pay attention to, what I reward perhaps, is something that I end up reinforcing. Maybe that's a good principle for parents to think about at times. What do I pay attention to in the sense of rewarding? What do I kind of give some good things for? And if I keep rewarding that, I'm going to keep reinforcing that. And you could apply that to other settings of life as well, I would suggest. It says, verse 13, "The poor man and the oppressor have this in common. The Lord gives light to the eyes of both. The king who judges the poor with truth, his throne will be established forever." And so you have a ruler in verse 12, you have a ruler in verse 14. In verse 12, we have something the ruler should not do. He should not pay attention to lies. In verse 14, you see that the king should judge the poor with truth. And certainly as long as I'm paying attention to lies, it's going to be very hard to judge the poor with truth in that situation. But in the middle of it, you've got verse 13. And I suggest that maybe there's some connection as well with verse 13. Why is it that the king should judge the poor with truth, and if he does so, his throne will be established forever? Because verse 13, "The poor man and the oppressor have this in common. The Lord gives light to the eyes of both." There's a similar proverb to that back in Proverbs chapter 22 and in verse 2. In Proverbs 22 and verse 2, it says, "The rich and the poor have this in common. The Lord is the maker of them all." If you're rich, you're poor, you're the poor, or you're the oppressor, God's the one that gives them life. God's the one that gives them light to their eyes. And so the king needs to recognize that fact. Not show favor to the oppressor. Maybe not fall for listening to his lies and divert justice from the poor individual in situations that might arise. Now, throughout the Proverbs, what we do towards the poor is kind of what we would do towards the poor's maker. In the book of Proverbs chapter 17 and in verse 5, Proverbs 17 and verse 5 says that he who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. He is glad at calamity, will not go unpunished. I mock the poor. I mistreat the poor. Whatever that is. That's a kind of a reflection upon his maker. How I treat God. It's kind of connected with how I treat others. And even those people that society may not really respect that much. Verses 15 through 21 I've kind of put together maybe in a section like the need for discipline. It begins verse 15. The rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. And so it begins kind of this section, at least as we've broken it down, with kind of the need for parental discipline of children. And if children are going to grow up to be wise, they're certainly going to need that kind of discipline. In Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 24, Proverbs 13 verse 24 says, "He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly." Parental discipline's a must if children are going to grow as they should. And in Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 15, there's at least two things involved. Maybe in parents trying to raise their children as they should. It talks about the rod and rebuke as instruments that impart wisdom. Both of these might fall into the category of corrective discipline, perhaps. I think rebuke, most of us can understand what that is. That's kind of like verbal, I think, corrective discipline. Someone does something wrong, you tell them it's wrong, you rebuke them. That's that part of the verse. And that's essential. But there's also a rod in the passage. And we need to maybe at times just think about, well, what is this rod that's being spoken of? If you go back to Proverbs chapter 23, I think you can find something that might help us understand what is this talking about. In Proverbs chapter 23 and verses 13 and 14, he says there, "Do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell." Obviously, this rod, at least in Proverbs 23, 13 and 14, is an instrument of corporal punishment that's used to kind of help train the child as well. And it's often, kind of, maybe not very often, but it's throughout Proverbs, it's kind of like references to it exist. Like Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 15, that foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of correction will drive it far from him. And so the rod's needed at times to correct. Now when you think about this corrective discipline, its point is not obviously to harm the child. It's not an outlet for the parent's anger or frustration. But it's maybe just kind of going to reinforce the lesson. Show that there's consequences to actions. And maybe to suffer that kind of consequences better than suffering what that would lead to eventually. And so maybe that's where God would say that you need a rod and you need rebuke to give wisdom. The end of the verse says, "A child left to himself is ashamed and brings shame to his mother." Now we can't just kind of let our children just do everything on their own and just be left to themselves, kind of raise themselves. However, that's not going to turn out very well. In the book of 1 Kings chapter 1, there's a statement made that may kind of help us see how this can turn out. In 1 Kings 1 and verse 5, David is near the end of his life, and Adonijah's son is going to try to make himself king. Verse 5, "Adonijah the son of Haggith exalted himself, saying, 'I will be king.' And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him." And then in verse 6, we're kind of told that his father had not rebuked him at any time by saying, "Why have you done so?" He was also very good looking. His mother had borne him after Absalom. Just kind of, his father's not saying anything, not rebuking him, not doing something about the situation. And when that happens, then certainly children are not going to bring glory or peace, but are going to bring shame to the parents. Verse 17 is going to come back to this subject when he says, correct your son, and he will give you rest. Yes, he will give delight to your soul. And that kind of goes back to that theme we already said that exists in Proverbs. A child's actions are going to impact the parents. But in the middle of those two, you have this statement, verse 16. When the wicked are multiplied, transgression increases, but the righteous will see their fall. Now, like we've said with some of these others, you could probably take that verse, and that's a truth that could kind of stand on its own. But maybe in the fact that it's kind of before it's a proverb about parenting, after it's a proverb about parenting, maybe there's something we can learn about parenting from this passage as well. You know, a failure to discipline your child properly, what's that going to result in? Well, it might result in the wicked multiplying and transgressions increasing. That might be the lesson we could learn. If you're a righteous parent, you fail to discipline your child properly, what might happen? Well, you might have to live to see your child fall. So maybe there's some lessons there as well. I think, again, that it could stand by itself, but there also could be those applications made. No, discipline, though, is not just needed from parents to children. God's people, in a sense, you could say, need discipline. And verse 18 maybe reminds us of that fact, that where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint, but happy is he who keeps the law. This statement, where there's no revelation, sometimes it says, and some of your translations might say, where there is no vision. And I think it's kind of become a verse that a lot of maybe like motivational speakers sometimes go to and say, well, you need to have a certain vision, you need to have a certain goal, and if you don't have that, then you're just going to never make it anywhere. That might be a truth, but I don't think that's what this verse is really talking about. The revelation, the vision that's spoken of here, seems to be prophetic vision, if it's a vision. It's kind of the word that's used in some of these verses, and we might not look at all of them, but just maybe a couple. In Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 1, it's the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, and the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. That's the kind of vision we're talking about in Proverbs 29:18. Not just some goal that someone might have set for themselves. In the book of Nahum, Nahum chapter 1 and verse 1, again, the burden against Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum, the Elkoshite. And so, again, it's prophetic type vision that we're talking about. The other two verses would go along with that. Ezekiel 12:27, Daniel 8 and verse 13. Maybe it's a good reminder that people need to keep God's word constantly before them. But what eventually happens is they cast off restraint. They get involved in things they ought not to get involved in. And so that's why it's important for us to have Bible studies, both individually and collectively. Why is it important that we have God's word be taught so that it kind of keeps us on the right path? Because if I kind of get that revelation far enough out of my mind, eventually I might become unrestrained. You see this play out in the event in Exodus chapter 32. In Exodus chapter 32, Moses goes up on Mount Sinai, and while the people are down there and Moses is up on the mountain, you see in Exodus chapter 32 and verse 25 that Moses eventually has to come down. He sees what the people are doing, and it says, when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies. They kind of cast off restraint in that setting. And so it's important that we kind of keep God's word always before us. People will either cast off restraint or there'll be people that keep the law. If you go back to Proverbs 28 and verse 4, kind of gives two categories of people there. Those who forsake the law, praise the wicked, but such as keep the law, contend with them. We're going to be in one of those two categories. We're going to either keep the law or we're going to forsake it. And we forsake it when we don't follow its teachings. Keep it when we obey its teachings. And Proverbs 29:18 says, happy is he who keeps the law. Happy is the one who follows what God has said instead of casting off restraint and doing perhaps his own thing. Verse 19 says, "A servant will not be corrected by mere words, for though he understands, he will not respond. Do you see a man hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than for him. He who pampers his son from a servant from childhood will have him as a son in the end." Verse 19, maybe we're reminded that not only do children need correction, but servants would have needed correction as well. And sometimes just words are not enough to correct people. Even sometimes when they understand what it is you're trying to say to them, sometimes they're not going to be moved to make the correction. And so sometimes there has to be consequences that kind of go along with the instruction. Verse 21 kind of has something again about servants. I thought about verse 21, and I'm not exactly sure what it's trying to teach. I think it could be one of two things. You could pamper your servant from childhood in the sense of maybe overindulge the servant. That might be part of it. Not maybe do some of the disciplining, maybe of verse 19, and the result is you have him as a son in the end. Maybe he kind of gets out of control and doesn't kind of tries to take over some things. That might be one view of the passage. The other view might be that here's a person that pampers his servant from childhood, or here's a person as a master that takes care of his servant, and as a result of that and treats him right, he has someone that's loyal to him, and so he has him like a son in the end. I do know that Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 2 talks about how that a wise servant will rule over a son who causes shame and will share an inheritance among the brothers. Those might be some thoughts. One of those two things. Obviously, I think there's a need to treat the servant right and just and fair. And there might be a warning not to just overindulge or not have any kind of discipline whatsoever, perhaps. In verse 20, though, between those two, it's kind of like a warning. Don't be hasty in your words. There's more hope for a fool than for a man who's hasty in his words. You kind of have that more hope for a fool as well in chapter 26 and verse 12. In Proverbs 26 verse 12, it says, "Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him." I suggest to you those two behaviors. Being wise in your own eyes and being hasty in your words often go together. If you think you know everything, you're probably going to speak too quickly. Maybe you'll speak before you know all the details, like Proverbs 18 and verse 13 talks about, that he who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him. Maybe we'll just simply speak without thinking about what we're trying to say, instead of doing as Proverbs 15 verse 28 speaks of, where the heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours forth evil. We don't maybe give as much attention to studying how to answer. You know, when you think about it, someone has said, well, maybe one connection as well that verse 20 might have to this section is that while there's a need to correct children, while there's a need to correct servants, there's a need to practice self-discipline as well. I need to have control over my speech, not be hasty in my words. The final section of this chapter that we're looking at tonight, maybe you could say it deals with the fear of man. That's kind of coming from verse 25, but I think we're kind of building up to it, and then we'll kind of deal with it and then kind of finish up the rest of the chapter. In verse 22, it says there that an angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression. Anger and fury, things that we need to be watching out for, things that can get us into a lot of trouble. These types of people, angry and furious men, were warned not to be around. Proverbs 22 verse 24 says, "Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul." It's interesting to notice what it says about these people, though. They stir up strife, they abound in transgression. The idea of stirring up strife is another one of those things that you kind of see it throughout the book. And here's just maybe a few references to it. Proverbs 15 and verse 18 says there that a wrathful man stirs up strife, but he is slow to anger, allays contention. And chapter 26 and verse 21, it talks about there that as charcoal is the burning coals and wood the fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. And in chapter 30 and verse 33 it says, for as the churning of milk produces butter and the wringing the nose produces blood, so the forcing of wrath produces strife. I can cause strife. I can cause problems among people if I'm an angry or a furious individual myself. And I can just cause a bunch of trouble. And so if there's trouble in all kinds of relationships in my life, if it seems like there's always strife, if there's always problems, maybe it's good to stop and think, well, am I one of these men that I'm just constantly stirring it up? I'm just abounding in that. And then he says that the furious man, he says, abounds in transgression. You know, you get involved in anger, you get involved in fury, there's going to be a lot of other sins probably you get involved in at the same time. You might have sins of the tongue, other attitudes and dispositions we might develop. And so we need to be careful about that. There's a connection, it seems, between verse 22 and verse 23. And you could maybe make that connection with Proverbs 28 and verse 25. Proverbs 28 verse 25 says, he who is of a proud heart stirs up strife, but he who trusts in the Lord will be prospered. Anger stirs up strife. Verse 22 of 29, a proud heart stirs up strife. Chapter 28, verse 25. And maybe what is the thing is that sometimes what's behind my anger, what's sometimes behind my wrath might be pride. And so maybe I need to address that at times. A man's pride, verse 23 of chapter 29 says, will bring him low, but the humble in spirit will retain honor. Sort of ironic, you could say. A person who is filled with pride is seeking, you could say, to exalt himself. And yet this verse says that man gets brought low. It's like what Jesus said in Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14 and verse 11. Luke 14 and verse 11. It says, for whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Humility, you could say, is not wanting to exalt oneself. And yet in the process, one is exalted, one receives honor or retains honor, as the passage says, in that type of position. Now, pride is something we've got to be careful about. We've got to watch. We've got to get in check if we have it. One verse that, as I was just thinking about this and studying some things for the lesson that caught my attention, is chapter 18 and verse 12. Proverbs 18 verse 12 says, before destruction, heart of a man is haughty. Kind of like 18, pride goes before destruction. Maybe the way it's worded there at least made me think, you know what, it's easy to be kind of haughty before destruction. Sometimes when things kind of fall apart, you kind of get humbled. And maybe that happens. And sometimes the way you get to honor is you have to be humble. And so that's maybe a prerequisite to that, as the rest of Proverbs 18:12 would say. You know, there are many passages, these aren't obviously exhaustive, that talk about God's attitude toward the proud. And Proverbs 3, verse 34, it says, surely he scorns the scornful, but gives grace, he says, to the humble. And Proverbs 6, verse 17, after he says, these six things the Lord hates, just seven are abomination to him. In verse 16, he says, a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood. And you might think about what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 3 when he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's kind of what God wants. He wants us to be humble, not to become a proud person. Proverbs goes on to say, verse 24, whoever's a partner with a thief hates his own life. He swears to tell the truth but reveals nothing. Maybe there's some connection. I don't know if there is a whole lot, but if there's some connection between 23 and 24, you have a proud man and he becomes a partner with someone who's a thief, he's not going to want to incriminate himself. He's not going to want to tell on himself, so to speak. But really, in a sense, you get verse 24 by itself, and here's somebody that's a partner, he's aware of a crime, maybe he's done something along with this criminal, and maybe he's called upon to maybe say something, and He's either going to have to lie, or he's going to incriminate himself, or he's going to have to say nothing. And he's kind of caught himself in this trap. And that's kind of something that we need to be careful about. Don't go in and do something sinful with someone else. And get ourselves in that kind of predicament. Verse 25 says that the fear of man brings a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord shall be saved. Kind of goes back to a little bit of that previous verse. I mean, if I fear man, I might just go along with the guy. If I fear man, I'm not going to want to say the truth in that type of a situation. Also, I could say that fearing man is oftentimes connected with pride as well. That maybe why I fear somebody, men, so much is because I'm afraid of what they think. And that goes back to maybe the fact that I'm trying to keep up a certain image. And so maybe it's my pride that maybe sometimes is behind all of that. You know, the Bible talks about people who fear people, fear man. And so it's not something that's just uncommon. But it's something that is dangerous for us to do. I'd like to turn our attention for just a moment to Isaiah chapter 51. In Isaiah chapter 51, we'll begin in about verse 12. He says there, God, I think, speaking, would say, "I, even I, am He who comforts you. Who are you that you should be afraid of a man who would die, and of the son of a man who will be made like grass? And you forget the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth. You have feared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor, when he is prepared to destroy. And where is the fury of the oppressor?" You might go down to verse 15 where he says, "But I am the Lord your God, who divided the sea, whose waves roared. The Lord of hosts is his name. And I put my words in your mouth. I covered you with the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens, lay the foundations of the earth, and say to Zion, you are my people." It's easy to get kind of afraid of man. What they're going to do. Maybe we forget that man, well, there's somebody that's created. They're going to die like us. Maybe we fail to remember, as we talked about this morning, the greatness of God and His power. The proverb says in Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 25 that maybe the solution to fearing man is in the end of the verse, that whoever trusts in the Lord shall be saved. Instead of fearing man, what should I do? I should trust God. And Proverbs 18 and verse 10, it says that the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. And so instead of running to men for refuge and approval and things like that, maybe I need to learn to run to God and those types of things, and to seek those things as well from Him. Verse 26 says, "Many seek the ruler's favor, but justice for man comes from the Lord." Why would a person maybe seek the king's favor? It could be. May not always be, but it could be, going back to verse 25, the fear of man instead of trusting God. Now, Solomon knew what it would have been like probably to have had people seek his favor, come before him, maybe wanting something or things like that. And yet the verse kind of reminds us, instead of maybe going to a ruler thinking that they'll fix all my problems, they'll get justice for me all the time. They may not always, but ultimately justice will come from God. Ultimately God will deal with things as they should be dealt with. In verse 27, he says there that an unjust man is an abomination to the righteous, and he who is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. I thought about maybe one of the things that can do for us is, if I spend my life fearing man, that's dangerous. Because the upright person, the person that I need to become, to some people, that's an abomination. Some people don't like that person. And yet if I fear man, that's the kind of person I'm going to be drawn to become. And so I can't fear man. That's going to lead me in the wrong path. The unjust man, though, also is an abomination to the righteous. The righteous, in that sense, you could say, is somewhat reflecting the attitude of God as expressed in Proverbs chapter 11 and in verse 20. where it says, those who are of a perverse heart are an abomination to the Lord, but the blameless in their ways are His delight. We said that Proverbs 29, maybe it's hard to just say, well, here's the theme. As we've seen, there's a lot of different things kind of covered. There's a lot of different applications you could make. Maybe, though, one way you could just look at it is like there's two paths in the book. There's two paths in this chapter. There's two paths really in Proverbs. And Proverbs is trying to say, here's a path and here's its outcome. Here's another path, here's its outcome. And which path are we on? Go back to chapter 28, verse 26. It says, he who trusts in his own heart is a fool, but whoever walks wisely will be delivered. I don't need to just trust my own wisdom. Some of the things we discussed in Proverbs 29, if it was just my own wisdom, I might say, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think that's going to work. And if I follow that path, that's the path that's not going to turn out well. I need to trust in God. And I can trust it. I don't need to trust in what other people say or the world says around about me. That also can get me in the same kind of position. When you go to the New Testament, in the book of James chapter 3, James chapter 3, beginning in verse 13, says, who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Say there's two kinds of wisdom. There's a wisdom that comes from above. There's a wisdom that's earthly, sensual, and demonic. Which one am I allowing to direct my life? And as I study Proverbs 29, I study other things in Proverbs, that's maybe a question I need to ask myself. So as we think about God's Word and what it teaches us, how am I responding to it? Am I like the man that we started out with? That when God's Word rebukes me, it shows me my faults, it shows where I need to change. Am I going to harden my heart or am I going to listen to it? Am I going to be somebody who just fears man or am I going to be someone that's trusting God? Am I going to be someone that when I have faults, I'm going to be one that repents of my sins? Am I willing to make that good confession as others have done before? Am I willing to be baptized for the remission of sins? And then will I continue to walk in the path of wisdom? If you're here this evening and maybe you need to make your life right with God. Maybe some of the things we've talked about are things that you need to correct or maybe something else. And we can pray with you and for you or help you in obeying the Lord in some way. Why don't you come as together we stand and sing the song which has been selected.
Will you come with your poor brother?